You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 25.
Altitude.
Tower, Delmar 6 is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector, loves me, I'm trying to get you today. My friend, Ram Gurbos at 354.
Viper 01, be advised, the restrictor 6002 is still active.
Turn in, lights on.
Doctor, picture 16,000.
Viper 1 targeted.
Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast. My guest today is retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Les Dyer. He has flown the C-7, the B-52, the T-38, the Hawk, the SR-71, and the A-10. He's forgotten more about aviation than I will ever know, and I definitely school girl out when we talk about the SR-71 today. So I hope you enjoy listening to his episode. Before we get rolling into the podcast, just a few admin notes. I would like to thank all those who've swung over to iTunes. They've left a rating and a review. Just hitting that 5-star and then going down and leaving even a 1-word comment helps the podcast grow. So I appreciate you doing that. Also like to thank all my Patreon supporters. So that's growing, trying to bring more content. There is some Afterburn swag that is rolling in and will be released here very shortly. So if you're interested in supporting the podcast and getting some swag and also just some either the uncut episodes, the early releases, or jumping to the front of the line for the new question and answer series that I'm rolling out, swing over to patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. You can find all of that on theafterburnpodcast.com. So plenty of links to go there, as well as some additional content for all the podcast listeners. Again, theafterburnpodcast.com, and you can find links to everything I've just rambled on about. Let's get an episode today with Lieutenant Colonel Les Dyer.
Well, sir, Les, thank you for joining me on the podcast. Excited to have you on here and hear a little bit about your aviation career and journey, because it's quite storied.
Delighted to be here, Rain.
Well, sir, if you wouldn't mind, just tell me, if you do like the 30-second elevator pitch, kind of a snapshot, if you can, of your career, what you flew, and what you're doing today.
Okay, let me start back in high school. Dad was an Air Force pilot. He'd come home every night with a smile on his face. He and Mom would sit down for a martini, and smile never left his face. So I don't think I thought about it, you know, actively at age 14 to 18 or whatever it was in those days, but it was the thing that I was going to do. So, you know, just sort of flowed, was lucky and got an appointment to the Air Force Academy, graduated from there in 69, and then set off. It was going hard and doing nothing but flying jets from then on. Chronologically, C-7s, B-52s, T-38s, Hawks, SR-71s, and A-10s.
It's quite a career, and it's fascinating to me just the number of aircraft that you flew. What was it like going through at that time and graduating the Air Force Academy? Obviously, the war's going on. Imagine that was definitely the forefront of your mind.
Yeah. Of course, at age 22, we're bulletproof and invulnerable. So, you know, going off to Southeast Asia, you know, you didn't think about anything other than, well, okay, I'm going to the war, and that's what I got trained to do, and here I come. So, you know. Flying over Hanoi and getting a few SA-2 shot at you was not a big deal at age 23, 24.
It's quite a different perspective. I imagine that would change today if you went back, that's for sure.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
What was a day in the life of, you know, flying around Vietnam?
Beautiful country, absolutely beautiful. I wish I could have enjoyed the scenery a little bit more, you know. Unfortunately, a whole lot of 20-foot-wide craters that were made by 500-pounders, you know, being dropped in the jungle and wherever else. But it was I was at Cam Ranh Bay, which was a beach base, absolutely gorgeous sea and sandy beaches. But days were fairly busy. When you were a trash hauler, you probably flew, you know, 10, 12-hour days most times, 7 or 8 sorties in and out of small special forces and army camps like that, moving people and supplies. So the year went quickly. It was not slow at all.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating to me. But you eventually transitioned into a little bit faster pointy-nose aircraft. What was the transition like going from the C-7? I know you said that the tweet was in between there, right?
No, it was a C-7, then the Buff.
Okay.
Then T-38s.
So going to the Buff then, what was your assignment like in the Buff?
Probably my least enjoyed flying assignment because, not so much because of the jet, but because the missions were long and tended to have a lot of boring twiddle your thumb times, you know. Two pilots up there, one of you flying, obviously, and they were long, particularly the ones flying out of Guam to Vietnam and back. And we're talking a 12-hour mission, normally took off in late evening in Guam, came back and the sun was rising in your face as you headed back eastbound. And so been in a three ship and had the lead navigator call out, and everybody in the other two airplanes was asleep.
Oh, man. But probably, I mean, that tempo that you guys were doing, those long flights, I'm sure you were flying several times a week. That, I mean, that wears on the body.
Yeah. Of course, once again, I'll go back to the age thing at 24, 25. You know, you're pretty resilient. Thought you were pretty tough, even if you weren't. But it got to you. It got to us so badly that Connie came over and we got an apartment on Guam, and she stayed for one of the tours.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How often were you flying missions when you were at Guam?
I think we probably averaged three a week. That's remembering back, but about that.
Wow. Yeah, I imagine it's a completely different world and a completely different, you know, time frame compared to what I think most guys are doing today. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe not. But that is fascinating to me.
I think probably the best thing, at least from my viewpoint, and I expect you would share it, although you didn't see that Vietnam era, was the fact that people are so good to you now. People, thank you for your service and stuff like that. That wasn't around in the old days.
Yeah, I can only, see what it has been on TV or what you read about or talking to veterans from that time period. And obviously it is a polar opposite of what you experienced coming back from Vietnam. You know, today, I mean, people are buying you meals when they see you in uniform at a restaurant, always thanking you for your service. If it somehow find out that you served, I think in the past like 3 days, I've had people thank me for my service. So I can't imagine serving in a time period, right, where you're going through a lot of hard stuff and then you come back to a thankless nation and really looked down upon by a lot of the populace.
Yeah, and of course, it obviously wasn't everybody was not like that by any stretch of the imagination, but it was, it got to you a little bit.
Yeah, I know that would have to wear. And so, I mean, with that, I mean, thanks for what you did. And obviously, I think things got better throughout your career, but your generation definitely had to deal with a lot of crap when it comes to that.
Yeah, well, things got, remarkably better, towards the end of the career, especially once the Reagan years started to come around. Money was there available for the military and the stuff we needed. So from that point on, things were sadly more upbeat.
Right. Did you just do the one assignment in the Buff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then on to the tweet to instruct, I assume.
T-38, yeah.
I don't know why I keep...
One of those trainers.
One of those little things that flies around. And yeah,
it's amazing to me that the T-38 won't be around much longer. We're going to have the T-7 here before we know it.
Yeah, I mean, it's about time.
Yeah, well, it's an old jet.
The fact that you and I probably have flown the same T-38 is pretty amazing. When you think
remarkable.
About that. Yeah, I have to go back and look at my logbook, but obviously I know I've flown several T-38s from the 60s, which, those things are bent and crooked and it's impressive. Yeah. They're still flying.
And not only that, the modifications, I'm not sure I'd recognize the cockpit anymore, with heads up and that sort of thing, even with an old jet like the Talon.
Yeah, it's obviously that's why I flew. I flew the T-38C, but I was maybe 2 years, 3 years in trail of the T-38s, when they went through the conversion, completely different. I mean, the plane still flies the same, but the HUD's cheating for sure.
Well, we got to get approaching a fifth generation fighter in here to teach our new guys. I mean, learning on the 38, leaves them with a big gap when they step into one of the, the modern jets.
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, flying the F-16, I think, is a very easy jet to fly. It's when it comes to employing it and all the different sensors and the tactics that go along with it, that's what becomes really challenging. So having an advanced trainer where you can, manage multiple sensors and doing things like that, that's what's needed to train for the next fight. So I'm excited to see the T-7 roll online. I think it'll be a really good thing. And again, the 38 is a little dated at this point.
Showing it's gray.
Yeah, but it's good. It's a good jet. And I really, this is what I want to get into, and maybe I've been rushing it, but the SR-71, like, I'm fascinated with this aircraft. I was as a kid. I think it was Mustang and then the Blackbird were the two planes that I was just completely fascinated with. And you had the opportunity to fly the Blackbird. And I want to talk a little bit about that. How was the transition into that? How did you land into the SR-71? And then we'll dig into it.
Just to back up a few steps, the previous assignment was an exchange tour with the Brits, flying the Hawk at RAF Valley in Wales.
Yeah.
So I was over there trying to get into the SR program, and the SR program basically involved a week-long interview back at Beale Air Force Base. So I had to make the trip to get from to England, UK, back to Beale and interview for the job and then see if they thought I was acceptable. Anyway, I go to Mildenhall to jump on a KC-135 to get back to Beale, and just so happens the SR squadron commander's in the bar the night before I'm planning to leave. So I got my interview from him.
Yeah.
At the bar over a couple of beers. So I kept the beer flowing for him, and it went fairly well there anyway.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and then went back to Beale, and they put you in the simulator, fly in the T-38 with a couple of the guys in the squadron, and interview with the bigwigs and the folks, Stanoval and whatnot, and did that for a week, and they accepted me, and went there in the summer of, that would have been the summer of 81. Long, long checkout program.
Is it?
You've got over 100 hours in the simulator before you fly your first operational mission. So it was almost the summer of the next year, summer of 87, before I went on my first operational tour to Kadena.
No kidding. Do you think flying the 38 and then the Hawk helped going into that transition and that flying interview, or unrelated?
Yeah, I got being not current, but at least with a lot of T-38 hours. The two sorties I flew there with the squadron commander and the DO certainly helped me there, because I flew it. I must say, I flew a decent T-38, so that went well. Having multiple aircraft background, I think, probably helped as much as anything. I'd seen various missions, a couple different kinds of flying, so I could take a look at the simulator and adapt a little bit, perhaps better than someone who was trying to get in, which we didn't see much of, with only one or two aircraft behind them.
Yeah, with the training, so 100 hours in the sim, roughly a year, were you flying the T-38 as you went through that? Or is there some kind of flying program associated with that training?
Yeah. The 38 was just a companion training, because once you got operational, you didn't do a whole lot of flying. Probably when you were gone to Kadena or Mildenhall, two sorties a week. And so the 38 was just to keep your flying skills up. We shared the 38 with our brethren in the U-2 who were just down the hall in the same building.
Okay.
And flew interchangeably with the U-2 guys. And so got a lot of 38 sorties. You get almost as much as you wanted 38 flying.
Okay. So year of training, and then you're out the door as an operational SR-71 pilot. I've talked to a couple of U-2 buddies, and that's the most experience I have with it. And some of the documentaries are out there. But you're still just talking about from a physiological standpoint and the gear you're wearing flying the SR-71, you're still wearing a space suit or a pressure suit, correct?
Correct.
Did you have to go through that same process of, you would step very early prior to the sortie and breathe oxygen, or is that a consideration and a factor too?
No. And that was, we felt fortunate over our U-2 brothers and the fact that we did not have to pre-breathe 100% in the SR. Normally refueled 15 to 20 minutes after takeoff at obviously medium altitudes, 25 to 27,000 feet. So you were 100% from the time you hooked up to the jet, went out to the SR,
okay,
went through the takeoff and refueling. So you had the necessary pre-breathing before you climbed and accelerated and got to the point where your blood needed to be oxygenated.
Yeah. So you had to hit the tanker pretty much right after takeoff, that 15 to 20 minute window. That was a normal kind of operating procedure for the SR-71, correct?
Yeah, the jet was a handful if you lost a motor with full fuel. So we normally took off roughly a half fuel load. And if you had an engine failure or a problem, then it was a lot easier to handle the jet and get it back on the ground. So you take it off at half fuel. That meant that you needed to hit a tanker fairly soon and fill up the full tanks and then climb and accelerate from there. Is this not that there weren't full tank takeoffs. We did a few of those. And,
okay.
They were always interesting, but they just meant it was a little bit a more tight-lipped on the ground when you had 80,000 pounds of fuel on the aircraft.
Love the one you're with.
Yeah.
I assume there's probably some good coordination that was going on between like the ops desk, you and the ground crew just on a normal day, right? Like if a tanker fell out, obviously that would impact the mission and that also dictate your, if you're taking on a full fuel load, or was that not even consideration?
Oh yeah, definitely. And there were normally, when we had the 135s, we usually had at least one tanker spare. And then we got the KC-10, they carried, you know, so much more when we were using those, it wasn't necessary normally to have anything more than, you know, one ground spare or something. But the 135s always had a spare or two there, particularly, and definitely more for operational missions when you were, you know, going someplace that you needed, there was a higher headquarters mission, you needed to make sure you got the offload and were able to complete the mission.
Gotcha. Did the SR-71, did that leak a bunch of fluid and gas on the ground until it got up to altitude?
Like a sieve.
Did it?
Like a sieve. Yeah, Kelly Johnson and those geniuses down at the Skunk Works designed the joints to expand once the airplane heated up and seal itself nicely. And we started out with a sealant on all the joints in the aircraft on the ground, but it didn't last long. The fuel ate away at it in the atmosphere and the weather conditions and whatnot. So normally, you know, after a flight or two, coming out of maintenance, that was gone. And you sat there, and if you had 80,000 pounds on board, it was squirting out like it was almost like it was a hose. 40,000 pounds dripped heavily, had huge drip pans under the airplane and, you know, whatnot. But she got up and went speeding out to it, heated up, sealed up nicely, and you didn't leak.
it's so wild. I mean, and it's truly impressive, like the engineering feat that plane was, especially in that time frame with what was available to design it.
And if I had one of those white plastic slide rulers, I'd be moving it here and showing you what they designed it on. I mean, they didn't have a Cray computer that did 5 gazillion, you know, computations per second. They did that on a white plastic slide rule, you know, and in a short period of time.
Yeah, it's wild to me. So mind-boggling what man was able to accomplish. So it's impressive. I'd like to talk a little bit about, from the ground to the tanker, kind of mentioned that. Once you're off the tanker, you're up at altitude. What does that climb profile look like? And then what is an average mission sortie, an operational mission sortie? Are you accelerating out to, and what are you doing?
Basically, we flew in multiples of 2 hours.
Okay.
If you refueled once the full tank, you'd go up, fly a supersonic loop, come back and land, and that'd be a 2-hour sortie, plus or minus a few minutes. To put tankers out there in front of you, then you could multiply those 2-hour supersonic legs as far as you wanted to go. I think the longest one I flew, which was certainly not close to a record in the SR, was about 8 hours. The French would not unless overfly coming out of Mildenhall. So we had to go out around the Iberian Peninsula, coming through the Straits of Gibraltar, and then overfly areas there in the Mediterranean that we were interested in, and then back home the same way. So 4 or 5 refuelings, I can't remember whether it was 4 or 5 on that particular sortie, was my longest. But some of the guys flew Baltic missions out of Biel, and that was a long haul to get all the way to the Baltic and get back, even flying, you know, north over the poles.
And I assume, obviously, you're having to drop down to altitude to get gas, meet up with the tanker, and then climbing back up. So it's a constant yo-yo up and down.
Exactly. Yeah. Of course, tanker was operating at, you know, the 25,000 to 30,000 foot range. And, you know, you had to go down to slow down, come down, meet him, get the gas, and then run the yo-yo acceleration, you know, all over again to get back up to speed and altitude.
Were you refueling about 300 knots?
Yeah, 300. Started in the 300 range. Unfortunately, that meant that heavyweight, as the gas came on, heavyweight SR usually ended up with one burner cracked,
yeah,
refueling and trying to get the tanker as he offloaded to go as fast as he can to continue to push up his speed, often had to do what we called toboggan. Tanker pushed his nose over, accelerated as much as he could in a shallow descent, and refuel that way until, you know, gas was passing and you got a little bit more operational, and as he did the same thing, was going faster.
I definitely can appreciate the min burner, the F-16, especially up at high altitude, I'll deal with the air quotes. weighted down for combat, you're usually tapping burner, which, and then you're like, am I being efficient here, or am I, you know, am I doing more damage? But
But you got that asymmetry, you know, sticking in there. And of course, depending on whether you're center line or the engines are farther apart, makes a difference as well, as you well know.
Yeah. Having one engine that's aligned down the center makes it probably a little bit easier than doing min AB with one motor or both of them. How did the SR-71, how did it handle at those low speeds? I imagine it liked going fast.
It did. And that was its regime and where it wanted to be. But if you had a lightweight jet, it handled very nicely. Use a traffic pattern as an example, down in the low weights, under say 20,000, it flew around the traffic pattern nicely. Used the stick shaker coming around to do the final turn, standard overhead, a little bit wider than an F-16, obviously, but not a bad jet to fly at all. You know, and handled nicely.
The speed of it obviously is super impressive. I did go Mach 2.04 in the F-16. It was super uncomfortable, and I was glad to be done with it, but I had to do it. I couldn't quite get to 2.05. but that was nothing in the SR-71.
So what it was designed to do. Once again, going back to Kelly Johnson, that team of super brains, it was designed to be do 3+, and that's where it wanted to be. Only jet I've ever been in where you push the throttles up if you got low on gas because you went faster. The inlet system got more efficient. You used, you know, less fuel to cover more distance. Yeah. Amazing in itself.
I imagine, were there any considerations flying up at that altitude and those speeds that was of concern, or you do anything different?
No, it was a cerebral airplane, if I can use that term.
Yeah.
Speed and altitude, you were obviously, particularly in the take area, you were trying to keep the aircraft as steady as you could so that the cameras or the radar were functioning properly. And as a matter of fact, you couldn't go into an operational take area unless the autopilot stabilization was working. Okay. So, you know, that kept the platform steady to take good pictures or good radar imagery, whatever you were getting. But other than special considerations, obviously, you know, being at 80,000 plus, you don't want to be outside at that particular time. But, you always thought about where you were, where the bad guys were, which way you had to do. If something went wrong, do I turn left or right? You know, if I get a, you know, unstart on this engine and I dip that way, I can't go too many miles or I'll be in trouble.
Yeah. And obviously the calculus is quite different than most guys are concerned about with threats and where you can go based upon the fact that you're covering 25, 30 miles a minute. So it can put you in a spot very quickly that you might not want to be in.
Yeah, and having, you know, fortunately, I was hooked up with the world's best RSO, reconnaissance systems officer, your teammate in the back seat. And those guys did all the work. You know, up front, you just get the pointy end going forward. And they had the threat systems, they had the cameras, they had the navigation, they had the radios. They did everything in the back seat. You know, up front, it was just hang on to the stick and make sure the pointy end went straight.
No big deal.
Yeah.
So operationally, you flew at Mildenhall. And then,
yeah, we had two jets at Mildenhall and the other one at Kadena.
Okay. And did you Kadena or is it just Mildenhall?
No, both.
It's okay.
Basically, normally, and we kept, at almost all times, we had 10 operational crews.
Okay.
You had two crews at each location, so there were four crews gone from home base at any given time.
Can you talk a little bit about your operational experience and some of the missions that you kind of partook on, and like what a day in the life of Slash looked like?
Yeah, let me pick out a Murmansk sortie, which was probably the bread and butter of the Mildenhall operations. Sinklant was a big user. He wanted to know where the subs were at any given time, so we'd run up that way and take pictures of Murmansk and the surrounding area. And obviously had the Ruskies over there on the the east side of the situation, and keep an eye out for, you know, denied territory there. Bread and butter out of Kadena, Okinawa, was the DMZ, the Korean DMZ. The powers that be over there wanted to know what the air order battle was, or the ground order battle as well. And so up and down the DMZ, was a typical mission would be across the DMZ from west to east, loop the other side and come back and do the same thing, come in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I imagine those probably, 4-hour, 6-hour type missions.
Four-ish was a standard for a double looper. as I said, one where you came down, got the second load of gas and went back up. You couldn't get a whole lot more out of the airplane than about 215. Okay. If you went up to full tanks, 80,000, flew a supersonic loop, and then you had to come down and refuel again.
I'm sure the RSO in the back, obviously he's got his to-do list of things that he's trying to knock out. But unlike today, most of that stuff is just being captured and encapsulated in the aircraft systems and downloaded once you get to base versus being data linked back. So obviously there's a lot of crew coordination that goes on between you and the RSO to make sure everything gets done, correct?
Correct. In those days, we didn't have data link, as you so correctly mentioned, and we were waiting for the photo guys, the specialists, to get everything downloaded when we got back on the ground, pull the film, pull the radar imagery, whatever the case was, take a look at it, and then get it up to the people who needed it at higher headquarters.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I wish the plane was still flying today, you know?
You and me both. The nose bolted on and off, a big nose bolted on and off with four bolts. I make it oversimplifying the situation, but you could switch between OBC, optical bar camera, and radar imagery, depending on what the weather was in the take area. So if the weather went south on you at a late date, then you could put the radar camera on if needed. Otherwise, you were taking optical pictures.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I always loved the story, like, I don't know who it was, but over Libya, you know, where they're running, getting shot at. And I think by the time it was all said and done, they were over the published speed limit.
Yeah, we operated. I think there may have been some exaggeration coming out of that particular story. But
10%.
Yeah, we operated on a compressor inlet temperature limit. And so you could take the jet up to whatever speed you could get out of it, as long as that compressor inlet temperature was not exceeded. And that depended on OAT. It was amazing at 80,000 plus how much variance you got in the temperature and the pressure altitude. I thought everything was pretty much standard once you got above the tropopause, but it wasn't. You know, I saw some really, really abnormally cold temperatures, which was good because it made engines run, more efficiently, and some darn warm temperatures, which was bad because it meant you were burning more fuel and had to watch the timeline really closely.
Yeah, I guess that's something, again, that's not a consideration I've ever had. Really, it's been a headwind or a tailwind is about as, with the big crayon marking on the fuel sheet, how exact I get with it. But if you're watching that, that's obviously going to change the calculus as far as, would it change the calculus, or was it that detailed that if it was an unexpected warmer temperature, that was going to reduce your range?
Well, our meteorologist and the planning shop, at a dedicated planning shop, took a really good look at that, and of course able to get weather data from weather balloons and all the things that we collect those pieces of data. So they usually had a good idea of what we were going to encounter. But if you hit something that was a long ways out of normal, we as a group lost a few sorties because the fuel line just got too close to, being, emergency fuel. So
Okay,
we got to get out of here now, cut this a little bit short and get on back and get some gas.
Well, that's what I'm sure the rule of thumb, for the T-38 hasn't changed much. There's slightly different intakes now, which I think, for fuel burn per mile an hour, you know what you're going to get at different altitudes. I assume the SR-71, that's probably what you were using a good bit. I mean, you did it in F-16, although we have mission planning software, but.
Yeah, exactly. And, you pushed it up, it accelerated, bumped through the first Mach by doing a pushover there as you were climbing about above 30,000 feet past the first Mach and continuing to climb. And then from then on, watching the inlets, how they were scheduling, and watching the fuel was probably the two gauges I spent.
Okay.
The largest amount of time looking at in the cockpit.
Yeah.
In that 1960s round gauge cockpit.
Right. Going Mach 3, no big deal. Gosh. Buckle up, folks. It's going to be a fun one.
It may not be fun, but it'll be fast.
Right. And it'll be over quick.
Yeah.
As far as, landing and performance of the aircraft, pretty easy plane to land, runway distance considerations, or?
Piece of cake. Nice, big, huge delta wing there. Took good use of ground effect when you were landing, so not a problem. Nice 55-foot drag chute that popped out on, your full stop landing. So they wanted us, have a minimum of 8,000 feet, but 5,000 feet would have done the trick if you had to have it, you know. Normally, the chute came out normal deployment, and you didn't have to worry about mashing the brakes too much. Just get on them lightly, and the jet would stop nicely in 5,000 or 6,000 feet.
That's crazy. Well, that 5,000 foot runway required there for you probably helped transition to A-10, huh?
Yeah, exactly. talking about going from the fastest to one of the slowest.
Right.
Yeah, that was definitely a change, but it was. I was lucky. Most guys that were in the program were senior majors or junior lieutenant colonels, so they're probably headed for headquarters, either you know, Omaha or back to the Pentagon to work the programs from the Pentagon offices there. So I was extremely fortunate to end up my career with another flying assignment after the SR.
So were you like a senior captain by the time you're done with your SR assignment?
No, I was a junior LC.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a second to last assignment. So I was had to have made LC the year before I left it.
How'd you transition to A-10? Like you said, that's pretty fortunate.
You just need to know the right four star.
It's all about who you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I was at Shepherd as a T-38 instructor, chief of the Sanibel shop. The two bullet at the technical training center there needed to have an IP to fly with. The gentleman, and he was a great gentleman that I was flying with, didn't need my help at all flying a T-38, but it was a rule in those days that there had to be an IP with a general officer. We got to be friends as much as a captain can be friends with a two-star.
Right.
And he went on to be the USAFE four-star. And so he just pulled me over from the SR to the A-10 there at Bentwaters.
Ah, man. Yeah. Better be lucky than good, right?
You betcha. Something going on my two-stone brain.
I love it. Yeah, how was your assignments in the Hog there?
It couldn't have been better. Flying the Hog out of Bentwaters was just awesome. We had four operating locations spread to north to south of Germany. So the idea was to probably block up the Fulda Gap when the Russian hordes came across with their tank and armor, and we were going to hopefully kill it out there on the North German plain. So spent a lot of time in Germany, which was never bad, and flying the Hog around the UK was pretty darn nice also.
Yeah, small world. I can't remember the gentleman's name now, but you know, I was at Shaw. We had an F-16 mishap a civilian plane and F-16 collided, but I was in the safety shop a few years after this.
The details, but I remember.
Yeah, so tragic situation. But the NTSB, when I was in the safety shop, I had to provide them some paperwork. But the investigator, I guess, had flown with you at Bentwater in the A-10. So it was a truly, truly small world.
That is a small world. 6 degrees of separation.
Right. Yeah. So it's one of those things that I definitely have learn, right? Because it doesn't matter if it's someone you come in contact with, today, you might not talk to them for 5, 10, 15 years, right? But, hopefully you were a good person and a good dude, because...
Well, the nice thing is we can not talk to each other for 5 or 10 years, and then friendships spring right back up like they had never, cooled off at all.
Yeah, prime example. I mean, you and I first met volunteer firefighting way back in the day. I mean, that was probably 2005, 2006 timeframe. And then obviously we've kind of kept in touch throughout the years, but that's what I love about my time in the Air Force is obviously the friendships you make. There are people that I don't talk to for years at a time. Right. But you can send them a message, pick up the phone and call them, and you're instantly connected, which is pretty
and,
cool.
And do a layover in his town and grab a pint and nothing's changed.
Yeah, no, it's pretty incredible. I mean, it's incredible. Just like, I mean, your career, I truly am fascinated. I'll be honest, a little bit jealous, just the number of aircraft you've flown.
Lucky, but good.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. So Les, I really do appreciate you joining me on the podcast today. I know people are going to be fascinated about hearing about the SR-71 and your entire aviation career. So thank you for your service and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for your service, John. It was an honor to talk to you.
Likewise.
Again, thanks for listening today. If you have any questions, you can swing over to afterburnpodcast.com and submit them there. And if you're looking to support the podcast or jump to the front of the line for questions, swing over to Patreon. Again, you can find a link over on the afterburnpodcast.com. We'll see you in 2 weeks.